WCFW HD2 Chippewa Falls, W228EP Eau Claire,
and streaming everywhere on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by O'Reilly Auto Parts.
I'm Stacey Lynn. Jamaica's bracing for what could be a catastrophic Hurricane Melissa, but many residents say they're staying put.
We're riding out the storm. No, we're not going to go anywhere.
Jamie Rome is with the National Hurricane Center.
It now seems virtually certain that the core of a powerful hurricane is going to move over Jamaica on a Tuesday. And not only that, the slow motion is going to mean those hurricane conditions, potentially major hurricane conditions, are going to sit or occur over the island for in excess of 24 hours. And the tropical storm conditions could linger for 2 to 3 days.
Residents are being urged to seek shelter. Airports have been shut down. French authorities have made a few arrests in connection with the jewel heist at the Louvre in Paris. The BBC's Aletra Naismith has details.
The two men were detained late on Saturday as part of an emergency police operation. One reportedly at Charles de Gaulle Airport trying to leave France, the other in a Paris suburb not long after. The Paris prosecutor confirmed the arrests, but complained the disclosure risked harming what is an extensive investigation. He said it was too early to provide more details. About 100 investigators are involved in the search, both for the remaining suspects and the missing royal jewels in what's been termed the heist of the century.
President Trump's on an overseas trip to Southeast Asia, which includes a meeting with China's leader later this week.
I think we're going to have a good deal with China. I think we're going to make a deal. It's going to be great for China, great for us. I mean, you know, we have a lot of things that are good for both.
Since last month, the U.S. military has been blowing up boats in the waters off Venezuela. The administration says they're smuggling drugs and calls it a counter-narcotics operation. On tonight's 60 Minutes, Senator Rick Scott seems to suggest Venezuela's dictator may also be a target.
If I was Maduro, I'd head to Russia or China right now.
Because?
His days are numbered. Something's going to happen.
Former Jets player Nick Mangold has died at the age of 41. The seven-time Pro Bowl center had passed away from complications from kidney disease.
I'm so very grateful for all the people who have helped me since I started playing football way back in the third grade, which is when my mom finally let me start playing, and she stuck with me throughout this whole journey.
That was from back in 2022 when he was inducted into the Jets Ring of Honor. Just 12 days ago, Mangold announced on social media that he had been diagnosed with a rare genetic disorder in 2006 and was seeking a kidney transplant. This is CBS News.
Think O'Reilly Auto Parts for all your car care needs. Get the parts and service you need fast from the professional parts people at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
You're listening to 93.5 The Tap, home for Matt and Aaron Air, weekdays from 9 to 11 a.m.
For Civic Media News, I'm Savannah Tomei Olson. October is Breast Cancer Awareness Month. Isabella Nieto tells us what doctors want every woman to know.
According to the American Cancer Society, 1 in 8 women in the U.S. will develop breast cancer in their lifetime. Dr. Cecilia Strode is an Aspirus Health breast surgeon.
We would like to see the cancers that we see to be screen detected, and for that to happen, we need women to have the screening that is appropriate for them at their particular level of risk.
Family history, genetics, and other health factors can increase your chances of developing breast cancer.
Most patients who get breast cancer, don't have an actual family history of breast cancer in close relatives.
Strode says patients who have received treatment for other cancers also have a high risk of developing breast cancer.
Women who have high-risk breast biopsies with atypical findings, women who have had chest wall radiation as part of cancer treatment at a younger age, before 30. And then there are some other things as well, but those are the big ones.
Breast tissue density can also increase your risk. Strode says denser breast tissue requires more detailed scans.
For women who have really extremely dense breasts, and that is an official term, extremely dense breast, MRI imaging is going to be a much better way to screen.
Strode says even women who have had mammograms that appeared normal need to have a clinical breast exam in case they do need a biopsy. Strode recommends women get their mammograms and disclose any changes they have noticed in their breasts to their healthcare provider. For Civic Media News, I'm Isabella Nieto.
And I'm Savannah Tome Olson. You're listening to Civic Media News.
You're listening to 93.5 The Tap, home for Matt and Air on Air weekdays from 9 to 11 a.m.
I'm meteorologist Mace Michaels. Mainly sunny for today, a high in the low 60s. A mostly clear sky tonight, low in the upper 30s. And more sun on Monday, a high in the upper 50s. After that, rain chances return for Monday night, Tuesday, and Wednesday. Right now it's 58.
Todd Albaugh.
Hey everybody, join us next time. We'll look back at the weekend sports and news headlines. I'll also be joined by our friend and colleague Jane Matt Nair of Matt Nair on Air. Join us.
The Todd Albaugh Show, weekdays 2 to 4. You're listening to 93.5 The Tap.
You're listening to pre-recorded content.
Welcome to Amicus, a law review with Jim Santel. Civic Media's weekly review and discussion of some of the most significant news stories in the areas of law, government, courts, and the aspiration for justice. And now, here's your host, Jim Santel.
This is Amicus, a law review, and my name is Jim Santel. I am your host here on the broadcast stations of Civic Media, both this hour and next hour as well, as we review a great number of stories, events, occurrences in our lives and our livelihoods in the areas of rule of law, delivery of justice, and government operation. Once again, as always, I thank you for spending some portion of your weekend hours in discussion, in engagement with me on these major issues. Let me tell you a bit about what is on our syllabus for our weekend broadcast. We are going to begin virtually where we left off last weekend. That is talking about some of these major criminal prosecutions of the president's adversaries, as he has identified them. We're going to talk about some developments in the case involving James Comey, some major motions that he has filed just this past week that have some legs, that have some focus and some substance to them that may alter, if not result in the complete dismissal of the case against him. We'll talk about the case paralleling that against Letitia James, who is the Attorney General of the state of New York. We'll talk about her appearance in federal court in the Eastern District of Virginia and the things that she said, reaffirming her lack of any acceptance of responsibility, a complete denial, as was anticipated, of anything related to the validity of the allegations against her. We'll talk more about that as well. Her plain entry of a not guilty plea there in the district court. And then we'll talk as well about the prosecution of John Bolton, which we just began to touch on at the end of our last broadcast last week. And we'll give you more detail on that. And we will advance once again this major theory that the Bolton prosecution is unlike those against James Comey and Letitia James. It partakes of both a case that does, in fact, arguably have some merit, probable cause to believe he may have committed some crimes, while also being on that list of the president's adversaries. And for that reason, a special lesson, a special note about the significance once again of what happens when a president becomes involved in decision making about who the federal government, who the Department of Justice prosecutes pursuant to a grand jury indictment and then in the trial courts of our land. We'll talk all about that. We're also going to talk about something else that the president has done in recent days, and that is exercise his authorities under the Constitution to commute sentences and to enter and issue pardons. We'll talk about that major pardon of this fellow called CZ, this major crypto defendant, now absolved of responsibility, a pardon issued with respect to him by the president. We'll talk also about the commutation of the sentence as to former Congressman George Santos. Again, an exercise of presidential power unchecked under the Constitution, not subject to any review by any other entity. following up on our previous discussions about the deployments of the National Guard in various cities around our nation, including Washington, D.C. and Los Angeles, and, of course, Portland and Chicago, focusing specially upon that Portland case and the Chicago case. We'll update you on what the Ninth Circuit is doing in connection with and a request for an en banc or all judge review of the case. We'll also talk about what the status of that Seventh Circuit case is as it percolates up at, yes, that's right, the United States Supreme Court. We'll give you a sense of what the government is saying about the reason why the Supreme Court, according to the Solicitor General, needs to reverse the decision of the Seventh Circuit. We'll talk once again about the comparisons between the Seventh Circuit case and the Ninth Circuit case and the divergent views that those two appellate courts have articulated in recent times. And then we're going to talk about yet another exercise of governmental and presidential authority, or lack thereof. That is these attacks upon Venezuelan boats in the Caribbean Sea, in the Pacific Ocean. We're up to 10 now. We're up to about 43 people killed in those military attacks on those boats. We'll talk about the ways in which interdiction by the Coast Guard with the assistance of the Navy has normally been the process by which interdiction and a response to believed drug trafficking on the seas has been addressed. And we'll talk about the ways in which the war powers of this president are being exercised in a way that some are increasingly saying are unconstitutional. Certainly the notion that he has identified and articulated, he has determined that we are at war with Venezuela, and that these cartel drug movers are in fact terrorists who are threatening our land. All of those determinations supposedly justifying his military action on these boats. We'll talk about that consequence as well, the consequence of his making that determination and the consequences for our international status in the world face. All of that is coming up on Amicus, a Law Review. We're going to begin, however, with a brief update with the Supreme Court, as we often do. A couple of things happening just this past week. We'll give you a calendar update to begin with, and that is the Supreme Court not hearing any oral arguments this past week, but back in business again in about a week or so, week and a half. On November 3rd, November 4th, and November 5th, they're going to be back in business entertaining oral arguments. And just this past week, the Supreme Court added a second gun case to its docket, now getting closer to 40 cases in particular. You may recall that the justices had already put on their docket for this term a case involving concealed carry on private property open to the public, merits and demerits of that. Just this past week, the court added a second gun case. And this new case that the Supreme Court is going to review is called United States versus Hermani, H-E-R-M-A-N-I. It arises from a federal prosecution of Ali Hermani. That's the name of the defendant. And the case that he was facing, the charges he was facing, in that the government was affecting his right, otherwise established under the Second Amendment, to possess a gun, based upon the fact that he was also engaging what the government described as the habitual use of marijuana, the interplay between drug use and the legitimacy of gun possession. The Trump administration, interestingly, has argued that the Supreme Court, should review the dispute after the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit. The Fifth Circuit said that the law that prohibits that kind of thing, that is the possession of a firearm while also involved in drug use, is unconstitutional, at least as it is applied to Mr. Hermani. The administration, to be very clear, is arguing here that the justices should support a gun regulation in this particular context. And in doing this, the government said that this case presents, according to the Solicitor General, an important Second Amendment issue that affects hundreds of prosecutions every year. And they describe this particular issue this way: whether the government may disarm individuals who habitually use unlawful drugs but are not necessarily under the influence while possessing a firearm. a timing issue here, a possession issue here, and a Second Amendment issue now back before the Supreme Court. The highest order here, the Supreme Court, you may recall in a major case a term or so ago, this United States versus Rahimi case, there the court ruled 8-1 over a vigorous dissent by Clarence Thomas, had ruled that the Constitution does permit the temporary disarming of people by the government if those people have been found by courts to possess credible threats to the physical safety of others. That's a domestic violence case. A domestic violence restraining order prohibits you from possessing, using firearms. And in Rahimi, 8-1, the court found that that is upheld and should be regarded in the federal courts as a basis for prosecution for people who are possessing weapons, using weapons, while they are subject to domestic violence restraining orders. All of that is a lot, and it is going to resurface again in this case called United States versus Hermani, another Second Amendment case determining, again, the interface between gun possession and gun use and drug use. Can you prohibit someone who is not necessarily under the influence of drugs while possessing a firearm, but nonetheless habitually uses drugs? Is that permissible? Is that constitutional under the Second Amendment? The Supreme Court agreeing just this past week to take that case up, a major case which we will continue to monitor here on Amicus, a law review. We also know that the Supreme Court continues to grant certiorari in a number of other cases, and that includes that major tariffs case. The lower courts, both the Court of Claims, the Court of International Trade, and the Federal Circuit, the courts below, have found that the president under the Constitution and under the IEEPA, this statute that the president has invoked to justify his invocation of powers to set tariffs and related impositions economically, that particular law and the Constitution that supersedes and is supreme over everything, both of those prohibit the president from engaging in the kind of tariff-setting work that he's been about for the past 9 months or so. Major decisions of two lower courts, a court of first impression, an appeals court, and now pending, defending before the United States Supreme Court. The Supreme Court going to be entering the fray, if you will, and having oral argument on that case on November 5th. And that case, again, will get a lot of attention nationwide because of the tariffs issue generally, and also because it underscores the focus of this term, as it has in recent terms, of the Supreme Court on the powers of the president. What can the president do under the Constitution? What can he not do? What can any president do given the restrictions imposed by the Congress, given the restrictions imposed by the United States Constitution? And what are the latitudes? What are the express things a president can do under statutory authority and also congressional authority conferred upon him? All of that's going to be before the Supreme Court again in this term, including on Wednesday, November 5th, when the court takes up this major issue of tariffs in America. But we begin with actions and activities going on, coming out ultimately from a building down the street, down Pennsylvania Avenue from the Supreme Court building. And that, of course, is at the main justice building at 9th and Pennsylvania. We have talked previously about these three, at this point, prosecutions of the president's identified adversaries, the people he has spoken about in the harshest terms. They also have been critical of him in many ways. And in the wake of that, that is the president's calling upon the Department of Justice and specific U.S. attorneys to indict his foes, the people in the political arena with whom he has disagreed. The return of indictments against James Comey, against Letitia James, and against John Bolton. The James Comey indictment, of course, was the first of those. Letitia James indictment followed that. Both of those cases pending and coming out of grand juries in the Eastern District of Virginia, based upon where the crimes there were allegedly committed. And again, we hasten to add as to all three that each one of these defendants presumed innocent until proven guilty. The Bolton case coming out of the District of Maryland, we'll spend some time talking about that one as well. All of them, all of this as Amicus, a Law Review, continues here on the broadcast stations of Civic Media.
You're listening to 93.5 The Tap, the Chippewa Valley's home for Matt Nair on air.
I'm Dan Schaefer. Let's recombobulate. The Wisconsin Department of Transportation just announced the official start date for one of its biggest ever construction projects, the I-94 East-West Project, which will reconstruct and widen a 3.5-mile stretch of interstate highway in the city of Milwaukee and Milwaukee County. This is a massive project with an estimated cost of more than $1.7 billion. And with this official start date announced, also came estimates for how long this will take. Construction is expected to last until 2030. At the recombobulation area, this project is something we've covered extensively, including with an award-winning four-part series called Expanding the Divide. It might be worth revisiting that series and considering how unnecessary and expensive an extra lane is and how in southeastern Wisconsin, we're going to be dealing with construction and delays for the next 8 years in order to shave a few minutes off suburban commute times while the city streets and city problems go ignored once again.
Find all of Dan's work at the recombobulation area.
Skilled trade workers are the backbone of every community and also the Army National Guard. Soldiers train to keep the power flowing, engines running, and in every other trade needed to accomplish the mission. These soldiers are on the fast track to learning skills that can set them up for success at home with companies looking to hire the best. Their resumes are being built through their paid training and part-time service. Find out how you too can learn a trade profession by visiting NationalGuard.com. Sponsored by the Wisconsin Army National Guard. Aired by the Wisconsin Broadcasters Association and this station.
Nightlight with Pete Schwalbe.
A very funny stand-up comic, Mr. Mike Toomey. The last time I saw a Goldie Hawn film in the theater, the male lead was giving her a foot massage, and it was the worst foot I've ever seen. I actually said out loud, I went, ew. And my aunt started cracking up.
Yeah, maybe they could have had a stand-in, like a stunt foot.
Or please, something. Even if it's a guy's foot, I don't care.
Nightlight with Pete Schwalbe. Weeknights from 6 till 8 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app. Civic Media. Local news, weather, and sports on air and streaming on the Civic Media app. This is the Civic Media Radio Network.
You're listening to pre-recorded content.
My name is Jim Santel, and this is Amicus, a Law Review on the broadcast stations of Civic Media. As always, in this, our weekly weekend broadcast, addressing some of the major issues in the areas of rule of law, the administration of justice, and the operation of government. That necessarily includes these days a continuing focus on an analysis of, at least up to now, these three prosecutions of people identified by the President of the United States of America as his adversaries. Let's begin with updates related to the prosecution of James Comey, the former director of the FBI, former member of the leadership of the United States Department of Justice. You recall well that James Comey, indicted by a federal grand jury in Alexandria, Virginia, that's the Eastern District of Virginia, right across the river from Washington, D.C., and he is charged in particular with perjury in his testimony before a Senate committee and also obstruction of Congress, obstruction of the proceedings of that very process. And so now, as a result of the return of that indictment, the court, the judge, whose name is Michael Nachmanoff, he is the federal district court judge who is presiding over this case in the Eastern District of Virginia, has not only accepted the not guilty plea from James Comey as a part of the routine process, but has also established a mechanism for the pretrial management of issues that the parties may bring to the judge. And that's the status in which we are in right now. And in that connection, Just this past week, one of the big rule of law stories of this past week, lawyers for James Comey have brought two major motions seeking the dismissal, the outright dismissal, getting rid of the indictment entirely if the judge agrees with them on the basis of, yes, that's right, prosecutorial misconduct, specifically vindictive prosecution. And also, interestingly, but not surprisingly, the allegation that the U.S. attorney, the interim U.S. attorney, brought in, as you may recall, for the specific purpose of seeking this indictment and obtaining this indictment from the grand jury after the previous U.S. attorney, his name is Eric Siebert, decided not to proceed with this prosecution as a meritless procedure. In the wake of all of that, the judge now saying, yes, you can file motions. And those motions are now before him. The motions from James Comey are two in number, and they do, in fact, allege vindictive prosecution and incapacity of the second interim U.S. attorney there to prosecute the case in the first case. Let's talk about those two motions. The first motion, again, is a direct assault upon the nature of what the U.S. Department of Justice is doing, not only in this case involving James Comey, but also arguably in the Letitia James case and likely in the James Bolton case as well. Remarkable, truly remarkable circumstances bring this together and make what is otherwise, would be otherwise, a highly unlikely motion to be successful in front of the judge makes it a whole lot more likely that the judge may consider this seriously and might even grant the motion to dismiss based upon the allegations set forth in the motion. What are those? Well, the motion begins with this fundamental notion, quoting again from the document itself, bedrock principles of due process and equal protection have long ensured that government officials may not use courts to punish and imprison their perceived personal and political enemies. That's what James Comey's lawyers are writing about. But that is exactly what has happened here. That's what they say. And indeed, what they're saying is that because the president of the United States has identified this strong and abiding and continuing animus, not only asking, but seeking and pushing for the indictment of James Comey, that is a vindictiveness. That's an animus that necessarily warrants dismissal. Why? Because it is inconsistent with the fundamental rules of prosecution, the rule of law in America. And if, in fact, a prosecution is premised not upon the law and the facts, but instead derives from a sense of hatred and animus and I'm going to get you type approach, if all of that is a part of what is happening inside and outside the prosecution, that is a basis for dismissal of the case itself. Now, traditionally, as I have noted already, these motions for vindictive prosecution are unsuccessful. I cannot remember a single one in the 30 years of my time in the U.S. Attorney's office as the U.S. attorney or as an assistant U.S. attorney. They may have been made, but they're almost always unsuccessful. They're very, very, very difficult to support and to win. And the reason for that is that the defense is obliged to present and prove two basic tenets, two basic notions. First, that the prosecutors, the government, the U.S. Department of Justice displayed some animus, again, some dislike, some opposition to the defendants themselves, while those defendants or the defendant was seeking to exercise some basic right. In here, in this case, the case involving James Comey, the allegation that indeed it's the president of the United States of America by virtue of the things he has said in the public domain about James Comey, asking for his indictment, describing him his way in ways that are set forth also in this motion, and doing it in response to James Comey's own expression of disagreement with and objection to the things that the president has done, exercising his right under the First Amendment. The second part of any motion for vindictive prosecution has to be that the charges would never have been brought except for that animus, that dislike, that disaffection, if you will, against the defendant. And here again, James Comey is able to establish likely an awful lot of support for that notion that he would not have been charged in this case. It is a razor-thin case, absent the fact that he has run afoul of the present chief executive. Now, as all of this proceeds, this animosity set forth in the motion will be the subject not only of this briefing on this motion, but maybe even oral argument if the judge decides to entertain that. When we come back, I'll tell you more about exactly what this motion says that the president said supports this notion of vindictive prosecution. And then we'll also talk about the consequences of this in the litigation, the prosecution of this case, and the other companion motion to dismiss. All of that on Amicus, a law review.
This is 93.5 The Tap.
You're listening to 93.5 The Tap, home for the Todd Allball Show, weekday afternoons from 2 to 4.
CBS News Brief. Hurricane Melissa set to pummel Jamaica. It is a huge threat, says the National Hurricane Center's Jamie Rome.
You're going to have to be in a shelter in your home for up to 2 to 3 days, possibly longer for communities that could be cut off by the catastrophic flooding.
President Trump says he's raising tariffs on Canada, blaming what he called a fake ad that featured Ronald Reagan advocating free trade. On Face the Nation, Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent was asked, is this just a negotiating tactic by the president?
I've read that the province of Ontario is spending up to $75 million on these advertisements. And you know, it's propaganda coming across our border to decry the tariffs.
And the top movie this weekend?
I can teach you everything. Let me teach you.
I might fall for this girl.
The anime flick Chainsaw Man pulled in over 17 mil. CBS News Brief. I'm Stacy Lynn.
The Badgers lose in Oregon. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports, college football. The Wisconsin Badgers losing on the road to the Oregon Ducks 21-7 on a rainy night. Wisconsin had 6 starting players injured and one of their best linebackers, Darrell Peterson, ejected in the third quarter for targeting after his hit on the Ducks' backup quarterback, head coach Luke Fickell.
This is a tough one to swallow again, but tougher because, you know, that there's some things to be proud of. There's also some things to be disappointed in. We can't play undisciplined. We can't have as many penalties as we have. We can't, you know, make really poor decisions, you know, one of our seniors to get ejected. That was one of those things tonight. We're not going to win a football game, especially against a team like this on the road. If we can't play more disciplined, we can't eliminate some of those big penalties. I think that stands out to me more than anything else.
So the Badgers are now 2-6. They have a bye next week, then host the Washington Huskies on Saturday, November 8th, with Sports on Mike Clemens.
On your entertainment beat, I'm Pete Schwabba. Some of you might remember Jeremy Renner from the less popular Bourne movie. It was pretty subpar, although not entirely his fault. In 2023, on New Year's Day, the mayor of Kingstown actor was seriously injured after saving his nephew from being crushed by a 14,000-pound snowplow. The Hurt Locker star had 30 broken bones, including 14 broken ribs, a spinal fracture, a broken tibia, a punctured lung, a sliced liver, a broken and dislocated collarbone, and a major head laceration. Season 4 of yet another Taylor Sheridan show, The Mayor of Kingstown, drops October 26th on Paramount. This is the age of the re-release, and you can add Wedding Crashers to the list of films that you can see soon on the big screen. The Owen Wilson Vince Vaughn comedy celebrates its 20th anniversary by heading back to theaters. Warner Brothers says the film will hit theaters again December 4th and 11th. For more showbiz fun, tune in to Nightlight with me, Pete Schwabba, weeknights from 6 to 8 p.m. on the Civic Media Radio Network.
93.5 The Tap, Eau Claire's real news and great conversation, and home for the Todd Allball Show, Monday through Friday from 2 to 4.
I'm meteorologist Mace Michaels. Mainly sunny for today, a high in the low 60s. A mostly clear sky tonight, low in the upper 30s. And more sun on Monday, a high in the upper 50s. After that, rain chances return for Monday night, Tuesday, and Wednesday. It's 60 right now.
Mornings with Pat Kreitlow.
They were it. That's the ballgame.
Adrian Klenz is executive director of the Center for Deafblind Persons. Those cuts, those programs would be rolled into something else. Is there a group deafblind children could be folded into?
There is no other program. Those 7 individuals have the specialized training to help those with dual sensory loss. There's no one else in the state of Wisconsin that has that training.
Mornings with Pat Kreitlow. Weekdays 6 to 9 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app. Matt Nair on air.
Attorney General Pam Bondi said that they had arrested the girlfriend of the head of Antifa. Troy from Mount Horeb is on the line. Good morning, Troy. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. I am the head of Antifa.
You are?
Yes, and I think my wife turned in my girlfriend. So,
oh, you're in trouble now, Troy.
Matt Nair on air, weekday mornings 9 to 11 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app. Pat Kreitlow.
On Monday, we'll talk about how the 2026 campaigns already feature several candidates hostile to the majority of voters who support women's health care rights.
Mornings with Pat Kreitlow, weekdays 6 to 9.
You're listening to pre-recorded content.
This is Amicus Law Review. My name is Jim Santel, your host this hour and next hour, as we discuss initially the merits and the demerits of these major federal criminal prosecutions against people like James Comey and Letitia James and John Bolton. Discussing right now the first of two major motions to dismiss the case against him filed by James Comey just this past week. In their motions, which are replete with specific references to the things that the president has said about James Comey, the lawyers describe in great detail the kinds of name-calling and the kinds of things the president has said, describing Mr. Comey, again, coming from the words of the president himself, describing Mr. Comey as a leaker, a liar, an untruthful slimeball, a corrupt piece of garbage, and a weasel who should be in jail. Heavy emphasis on that because it suggests once again the vindictive nature, the animus that is needed to be successful in a motion like this. In fact, there's so much in this motion, there's so much to support this notion that Donald Trump is focusing on his animus toward James Comey and wants him prosecuted, wants him convicted, wants him sentenced, presumably, that the judge, Michael Nachmanoff, actually afforded the prosecutors an enlargement of the number of pages that they would all otherwise be limited to describe the number and the ferocity of these attacks by the president upon James Comey. The animosity that they describe, they note, also extends so far and runs so deep that it goes into James Comey's family itself. They note a part of our recent history that in July, the Justice Department actually fired from her longstanding employment an assistant United States attorney named Maureen Comey. She is the daughter of James Comey, receiving excellent reviews routinely and purportedly fired simply because her last name is Comey, that she is the daughter of this person against whom the president holds so much animosity. And so all of this in support of this notion that this case is not premised upon facts and law. It is premised instead upon an interest by this president in convicting an enemy of his, an adversary of his. During the course of the lead up to this, in which, again, the president replaced the prior U.S. attorney, who decided there was no there, that this case could not be prosecuted, replaced that U.S. attorney with another one. The president posted to his social media account just before that, directing the Department of Justice to return this indictment, identifying that Comey and others are guilty as hell, and ordering his attorney general to prosecute Comey now, capital N, capital O, capital W, with three exclamation points. All of that supporting this notion that indeed this is premised not upon the facts and the law, but instead upon this animus that the president has, supporting, giving legs to a motion that would otherwise be very difficult to show, and that the charges here would never have been brought but for that animus of the president against James Comey. It is interesting to note along the way that there's another development in all this that further confuses this. It's not central to this motion, but it's significant that in the charge itself, there is this description of James Comey responding to Ted Cruz, who is the senator from Texas, who is quizzing him during the course of this Senate hearing. And it's during the course of that that James Comey allegedly perjured himself, making a false statement about whether or not he asked someone at the FBI to be an anonymous source in news reports, referring that person to some media outlet. And James Comey responds in that setting, no. And it is that statement, no, declining to admit because it did not happen, that he told this other person to go to the news media. The indictment also, of course, says that Comey then misled the committee by saying that he had not done so, thus obstructing their proceedings. That's the second count in the indictment. The assumption has always been that the person that Comey allegedly authorized to reach out to the media was a fellow named Andrew McCabe, who once served as his deputy. You may remember his name from some previous proceedings there, to leak information to the news media. But some recent discovery produced in this case is indicating more and more that the prosecutors believe that Jim Comey lied about a different former FBI employee, and his name is Daniel Richman, R-A-C-H-M-A-N. It is confusing at best. It is imprecise at worst, and it will probably be the subject of even more motions down the road, perhaps for a bill of particulars as this case goes forward. But it underscores once again the lack of precision, even in the drafting of this complaint, even in the drafting of the charge that is the first count in this indictment. And then beyond the vindictive prosecution motion, there is a second one, and that is premised upon the notion that the attorney, the U.S. attorney, who finally did present this to the grand jury and who was successful in returning this indictment, that person was improperly appointed by the Department of Justice, by the president, and holds her post without the legal authority to do so. And so, therefore, the argument goes, the case against James Comey that she presented to the grand jury that she is now prosecuting, that case itself should be dismissed in its entirety because of a lack of authority in the prosecutor herself. Now, typically, the attorney general is permitted to appoint an interim U.S. attorney for about 120 days without Senate confirmation. I should say here that the rules and the regulations behind this, when you have an interim U.S. attorney, that is between United States attorneys who are nominated by a president and confirmed by the Senate, you have to have somebody in that position to make decisions and keep the boat afloat and keep the U.S. attorney's offices operating as they should as a part of their regular civil and criminal litigation assignments. So what you do is you appoint an interim U.S. attorney, but under the law, under the rules established by the Congress, there's only 120 days for that interim appointment to remain. And so Comey's lawyers are arguing that U.S. Attorney Halligan, who was the successor to U.S. Attorney Siebert, he was the fellow once again who left, arguably was fired when he found that there was no basis to prosecute Jim Comey, that Ms. Halligan's term of office is not existent at all because Eric Siebert himself had already served a 120-day period as the interim U.S. attorney, absent the possibility of stacking those 120-day terms on each other. There is no authority then for the president to appoint a subsequent United States attorney in the wake of Eric Siebert. And the basis then for the motion is that absent her authority, she had no capacity under the law to present this to the grand jury, had no capacity, as she can do otherwise, to sign off in the indictment. We know that she herself appeared in front of the magistrate judge, who had a difficult time in trying to figure out which of the documents in front of her was the real indictment, which one was the one that the grand jury had discarded. All of that premised upon this expiration of a 120-day period for any interim U.S. attorney, not extending into the term of interim U.S. attorney Halligan. That's the basis for the secondary motion filed by James Comey. It is in the weeds. It is very wonky. But again, it goes to the very core of this case, even though neither one of them addresses specifically the substance of the charges, which I've just described once again. That, of course, could be the subject of more motions and more hearings. And specifically, that's the kind of thing that if indeed this case survives these motions to dismiss, which it may well not,
If this does go to trial, that's when James Comey will have his opportunity to present, probably in the course of just a few days, probably under a week, his defense to this charge of perjury and obstructing the proceedings of the Congress. The prosecutor in this case, who is brought in, interestingly, to handle the case, his name is Roger Keller. He's brought in from the Eastern District of Missouri into the Eastern District of Virginia, probably to supplant, to take the place of the U.S. attorney, who is not skilled, has no experience in prosecuting these cases. That substitute prosecutor has indicated that the government has about 10 witnesses to present in support of the prosecution of James Comey. James Comey likewise will present his witnesses, very likely will testify in his own behalf, which is one of those issues that defendants always face in criminal cases. Do I testify or not? Here, the jury will need to hear from him that he did not commit this perjury, did not obstruct these proceedings. It will also be interesting to hear and see exactly who those witnesses are who would establish clearly that the thing that James Comey said at trial, his answer to the question, no, that I did not encourage my subordinate, my patriot, my compatriot in the FBI to go out and engage with the media, that person also has to come forward, one would think, to provide that basic information that would support the claim of a false statement, of perjury. There's a lot going on there. These motions just filed this past week, anticipated fully, but changing arguably, dramatically, the landscape of this case. Entirely possible that the Judge Nachmanoff in this case could grant those motions and dismiss the case entirely. Of course, the prosecution has the right, as they certainly will do, to push back on all this. They'll file a response to this motion, and the defense then will have a chance to file a reply as well. If the case is in fact dismissed, certainly the government will appeal this to the appeals court. And then we'll go down that road, arguably one day, depending upon what the appeals court does, landing in the Supreme Court as well. It is a lot going on inside this case. But the reason I bring it up is because it will also animate certainly the cases, the prosecutions against Letitia James and John Bolton as well. We know that Letitia James just late this past week appeared in front of the federal district court judge in the Eastern District of Virginia. His name is Judge Jamar Walker. He has now been assigned the prosecution of the case against her. And you recall well that she herself has been indicted in two counts. The first count accusing her of committing bank fraud by seeking to defraud some financial institutions. The second count accuses her of making false statements to one of those banks. All of that in connection with her purchase in 2020 of a home in Norfolk, Virginia. The document, the indictment, accuses her of having said in some loan documents that she would use the home as a secondary residence, secondary to the one that she has in New York, but instead that she used that home as a rental property. That, they say, is the false statement to the bank. And they say that violated the mortgage agreement and allowed her to receive some more favorable loan terms. Interestingly, the indictment says that she saved somewhere around $19,000 over the life of the term, candidly, a very low amount given the standards of prosecution for U.S. attorneys' offices around the country. Some reporting more recently of an internal memorandum that not only casts more doubt on the legitimacy of this prosecution, like the prosecution of James Comey, but also suggests that the amount of loss is wildly overstated, perhaps bringing it to an even lower number. Letitia James will also certainly raise the same kind of vindictive prosecution allegations and arguments that James Comey has raised in his motions. She will obviously identify the things that the president has said about her in recent times in the public domain. And she will almost certainly also address this issue of whether or not the U.S. attorney in that same district had the capacity to indict her in the first place. The same U.S. attorney, same kind of thing before a different judge in the same district addressing many of the same issues, almost certainly in the Letitia James case. Finally, when we come back, we'll talk about James Bolton once again, tell you more about that, and tell you why it's different from those other two cases here on Amicus, a law review.
Connecting audiences, powering brands. This is Civic Media. Learn more at civicmedia.us/advertise.
Cranberry juice, cranberry wine, cranberry brats, cranberry cream puffs. And excuse me, but my cranberry bread is ready. It's cranberry season in Wisconsin, and we're the cranberry capital of not just the U.S., but our farmers also produce more than half of the world's cranberry supply. So can you guess which state Wisconsin beat out to earn the number one spot? New Jersey? Washington State? Massachusetts? The answer coming up. Fall is harvest time, and you can see the machines rolling through the marshlands, which are flooded to help the cranberries float to the top. But it hasn't always been this easy. Back in the mid-1800s, the berries had to be picked by hand. It took another 100 years for the right equipment to be built to help with this harvest. Okay, so Wisconsin owns the cranberry capital title, but which state lost it to us? Massachusetts, which has been number two ever since. By the way, the cranberry is the official state fruit, making it a true slice of Wisconsin. I'm Terry Barr for the Civic Media Radio Network.
You're listening to the American Democracy Minute, keeping your government by and for the people. The North Carolina legislature passed a new gerrymandered congressional map October 22nd, likely adding a GOP congressional seat to offset expected 2026 midterm losses in the U.S. House. Legislators diluted black voting power to do it, but say it was for partisan reasons. The map likely gives Republicans an 11-3 advantage in a purple state where President Trump won by only 3.3% in 2024. State leaders went out of their way to say it was manipulated to help maintain GOP control of the U.S. House. State Senator Ralph Hayes said, "The motivation behind this redraw is simple and singular. Draw a new map that will bring an additional Republican seat to the congressional delegation." Why admit the cheating? The U.S. Supreme Court's Rucho decision said gerrymandering for partisan reasons was a state political matter, not a matter for the federal courts. For the moment, racial gerrymandering is still illegal under the Voting Rights Act, so the deliberate admission of partisan gerrymandering helps to create an alibi when the case reaches federal court. The new map changed only Congressional District 1, a currently competitive Northeast district where black Congressman Don Davis won by 2%. A North Carolina Black Alliance analysis shows it shifted 8% of black voters into adjoining redder districts, diluting black voting power and tilting District 1 Republican. We've linked to more at AmericanDemocracyMinute.org.
Here's a dose of reality. Driving under the influence of prescription painkillers is just as illegal and just as deadly as driving drunk. In fact, there are nearly 2,000 drug-related crashes every year in Wisconsin. Help prevent drug-to-driving and let's achieve zero preventable deaths on Wisconsin roadways. Driving on pills kills. Sponsored by the Wisconsin Departments of Health Services, Transportation, and Justice.
As Wisconsin is saying the word bag instead of bag, this is the Civic Media Radio Network.
You're listening to pre-recorded content.
My name is Jim Santel. This is Amicus, a law review on the broadcast stations of Civic Media, spending virtually all of our first hour this weekend with you discussing these major prosecutions of, yes, the president's enemies. He has identified them as such, as adversaries. They have criticized him and been very, very critical of him in his conduct as a president. And he has returned that kind of emotion and that kind of language in their direction as well. The things that the president has said with respect to James Comey and Letitia James and also James Bolton are the very things that are now showing up in the motions to dismiss the very cases that the president himself wanted to have prosecuted. The language that he has used describing them as being guilty as hell, wanting them to be prosecuted, that very language is now the basis for these vindictive prosecution motions, one already filed by James Comey, the other one certainly coming in the case involving Letitia James, saying that it's because because of the president's comments and the encouragement to the attorney general and to the U.S. attorney in Eastern Virginia that these cases have been prosecuted, and not because there is a factual or legal basis for doing so. That's vindictive prosecution. Also, these motions based upon the incapacity, alleged incapacity of the interim U.S. attorney to bring the case in the first instance. Then there's the James Bolton case. Again, it follows in the wake of the Comey and Letitia James prosecutions. It is, as you know, premised upon an indictment, 18 counts, accusing John Bolton of using his personal email and also a messaging app of his own to share about 1,000 pages of what are called diary notes of his daily day-to-day activities as Donald Trump's national security advisor in 2018 and 2019, a time obviously went during the course of the president's first term when John Bolton was in that capacity. Those notes, according to the indictment, this 18-count indictment against John Bolton, allegedly sent to some family members who did not have security clearances, as John Bolton did. And according to the allegations in the indictment, that information included some national defense information, details classified as top secret, and other materials that are related to the national security of our nation. You may recall well that in a previous report, and a lot of coverage in August of this year, some FBI agents descended upon John Bolton's personal residence. This one, not in Eastern Virginia, but in Maryland, in the District of Maryland, still in Bethesda, just outside of the nation's capital. And they were carrying out from his home a number of boxes with all kinds of documents. That search, of course, pursuant to the Fourth Amendment of the Constitution, premised had to be upon a finding by a federal magistrate judge that there was probable cause to believe that there was evidence of a crime, that John Bolton was in fact possessing these documents, something that would support a finding of probable cause of criminal activity. And it was in the wake of the removal of those documents that this indictment was issued. Now, significantly, this particular prosecution, unlike the Comey and James prosecutions, had been going on, the investigation going on for many years, went back in terms of time to the Biden administration. This has already been under investigation. Some folks there making the determination that there was not enough to indict during that term. But coming back again to the present U.S. attorney named Kelly Hayes, U.S. attorney in Maryland. This is now a different U.S. attorney than the one who is prosecuting James Comey and Letitia James. And there, this case does not suffer from the sudden transfer from one U.S. attorney to another, doesn't suffer from the internal problems, the internal statements in the public domain or suggested in the public domain that there is no case here. In fact, U.S. Attorney Hayes is a longtime career prosecutor who signed off on the charges in conjunction with the Department of Justice's National Security Division. That gives you some reason to believe that, yes, indeed, there is at least probable cause to believe that a crime has been committed here. We hasten, as always, to note that any defendant, including John Bolton, is presumed innocent until proven guilty. He will also have his chance to present his case at trial. But the difference between this one and the others is that there's a there. And it seems, at least on the surface at this point, yes, probable cause to believe that John Bolton may have committed these crimes involving the retention and the transfer of classified materials to members of his family, that in violation of federal law. And there is, in fact, a there. There's a basis for believing that this case, even independent of the president's allegations and the statements made about John Bolton, would have gone forward. And there's the rub. And there's the problem, as we described at the end of our last broadcast last weekend, which is John Bolton's case partakes of both what may be a legitimate prosecution and also an illegitimate prosecution. Why? Because it also can suffer from a motion to dismiss for vindictive prosecution, suffer in the wake of the president's equally dramatic and vindictive and animus-related statements against John Bolton. And so the difficulty is that the president once again arguably dooming the very prosecution that he wants against John Bolton by saying these things in the public domain about John Bolton. And yes, I should note John Bolton returned those statements in kind. But by doing that, the president has actually compromised the very prosecution that he wanted to proceed. And in doing so, it's made it entirely possible that the judge here in this case, the John Bolton case, may in fact also embrace a vindictive prosecution notion and could dismiss an otherwise legitimate prosecution based upon probable cause and real facts. That's the problem, Mr. President, in doing what you're doing, in articulating not only these things about people who are have run afoul of you, but by directing the Department of Justice to issue these indictments to go after these people. When we come back in our second hour, some final comments about this process and other adversaries who may still be out there subject to indictments as we move on then in other areas of the rule of law and the delivery of justice in America here on Amicus, a Law Review.
You're listening to 93.5 The Tap, WCFW HD2 Chippewa Falls, W228EP Eau Claire, and streaming everywhere on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by O'Reilly Auto Parts.
I'm Stacy Lynn. We begin with a massive storm. Philippe Pappin with the National Weather Service has the latest on Hurricane Melissa.
Even though the core of Melissa is likely to pass just to the west of Haiti, they're already getting some catastrophic rainfall. And we're actually expecting rainfall totals between 15 to 30 inches with local maximums of up to 40 inches possible. There's already catastrophic flash flooding ongoing, numerous landslides, and unfortunately, this is going to be a very high impact event.
The storm's already to blame for 3 deaths in Haiti and 1 in the Dominican Republic. It's making a beeline for Jamaica now. CBS's Jason Allen is there.
Winds are now starting to pick up a little bit in Kingston, Jamaica, after really what was a calm Sunday morning. And with those winds, we're now getting intermittent bursts of heavy rain as the bands from Melissa start to cross the city.